December 2011, an explosion at a munitions depot belonging to Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in a Tehran suburb martyred at least 36 people, including General Hassan Moqaddam. In November 2020, Iran blamed Israel for being behind the assassination of one of its most prominent nuclear scientists. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who headed the country's Defense Ministry's Research and Innovation Organization. In July 2020, Natanz was also targeted by an explosion that damaged a facility making advanced centrifuges. Last July, a fire broke out at the same site. However, Iran says no level of assassinations or explosions will prevent Tehran from expanding its nuclear program. In the aftermath of the martyrdom of Fakhrizadeh, the Iranian parliament passed a bill that allowed the country to resume enrichment of uranium up to 20% purity, as was the case before the JCPOA. New advanced centrifuges are also being installed at Natanz. Furthermore, Iran's top negotiator at the Vienna talks says the Islamic Republic has informed the International Atomic Energy Agency of a plan to immediately start 60% uranium enrichment. This is the highest figure ever that Iran has enriched uranium.
We send a letter to the agency that we are going to add 1,000 more centrifuges to Natanz facility. That is in addition to the current number of machines. Also today, we just send a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%.
The White House spokesperson described the ramping up of uranium enrichment by Iran as provocative.
Take seriously Iran's provocative announcement of its intention to begin enriching uranium to 60%, which the P5 plus one should be unified in rejecting.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on a brand new episode of The Lantern. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen that we've been blessed with this opportunity to spend a few minutes of our day on reflecting and thinking about matters that, you know, sometimes we honestly don't have the time to consider because life happens and the world has been so chaotic lately. And the other day I was watching my niece color some unicorns because she's absolutely obsessed with them. And as she was coloring the unicorns, it reminded me of a short anecdote, a short little parable story that I think you guys will probably find interesting as well. So let's listen to our story. And we're going to be right back, so please stay with us.
The title of today's story is Parable of the Pencil. The pencil maker took the pencil aside just before putting him into the box. "There are five things you need to know," he told the pencil. "Before I send you out in the world, always remember them and never forget, and you will become the best pencil you can be. 1. You will be able to do many great things, but only if you allow yourself to be held in someone's hand. 2. You will experience a painful sharpening from time to time, but you'll need it to become a better pencil. 3. You will be able to correct any mistakes. 4. The most important part of you will always be what's inside. And 5. On every surface you are used on, you must leave your mark. No matter what the condition, you must continue to write. The pencil understood and promised to remember and went into the box with purpose in its heart. Now, replacing the place of the pencil with you, always remember them and never forget, and you will become the best person you can be. Again, the conditions. 1. You will be able to do many great things, but only if you allow yourself to be held in God's hand and allow other human beings to access you for the many gifts you possess. 2. You will experience a painful sharpening from time to time by going through various problems in life, but you'll need it to become a stronger person. 3. You will be able to correct any mistakes you might make. 4. The most important part of you will always be what's on the inside. And 5. On every surface you walk through, you must leave your mark, no matter what the condition. You must continue to do your duties.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Now, I don't know who wrote this story, but I found it really interesting and to a certain degree quite on point. And if we really take every point that was made into the story and try to actively apply it into our lives, interestingly enough, we will find that things will fall into place better and easier and will flow smoothly. Life is always going to be complicated at the end of the day. There's going to be some rascal of a child that pours all the coloring pencils out of its box and breaks it and scatters it all over the house and draws on things that they shouldn't be drawing and this and that. If we apply that into our lives, well, life sometimes gets complicated. Sometimes people come into our lives that influence us and impact us in a very negative manner. Sometimes the circumstances of life lead us to do things that we weren't necessarily comfortable with, or we didn't even think that it was within our capacity to do. But all of this, at the end of the day, are tests and trials, and they're ways for us to actually figure out and learn what we're really made of. What kind of potentials do we have, and when the going gets tough, how tough can we possibly be? I especially enjoyed the first point that the story made, where it said, always remember that you're going to be in someone's hands. That might sound kind of scary and unpleasant, especially those who are obsessed with individualism and invest too much onto their personal ego and identity and forget that we are from the Lord, and to the Lord do we return. No matter what we have in this life, even if there is no such thing as the hereafter, one day we will all die. The most atheist or agnostic or mystic or nihilistic or any person with any sort of ideology and doctrine still agrees on the fact that we're all going to die at the end. And once we do, after a while, it would be as if we never existed, in all honesty. And all that's left of us is how we were able to positively affect this world and the people around us. So even if we don't believe that we're in the hands of a divine, almighty, all-knowing, all-merciful power, we're still in the hands of time. We're still in the hands of our biological clocks that sort of a sand watch or a sand clock that the grains of sand slowly but surely flow through, and at some point they're still going to finish, right? So we're still at the hands of something. We're not entirely free as we think ourselves to be. So how wonderful would it be if we left ourselves in the hand of an entity which is just, which is kind, which is beneficent, which is forgiving, which knows what's best for us, and has facilitated and accommodated all of our needs and requirements, and who only cares about our wellness, our betterment, our felicity and success in this world, and especially in the hereafter. Especially in the hereafter, because that's our true abode. That's where we're meant to last forever. That's the place that once we have a transition to, we get to stay there and enjoy all the bounties till the end of no time. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. I'm so happy that you guys were with us. Inshallah, I hope you've enjoyed it and benefited from it like I have. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
أنا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
الله هو ذا الرحمن الله هو ذا المنان.
لا إله إلا.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we're trying to answer questions, doubts, or misconceptions which are being asked or are sent to this radio station with regard to Islamic theology. For this, we try to invite Islamic scholars and speakers from Qom Seminary schools. Like always, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to help us with his answer to the questions which are going to be asked concerning the holy month of Ramadan. The questions that we have and we shall answer, inshallah, and we shall pose and talk about are mostly in this very session about the holy month of Ramadan. Shaykhana, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation. Shaykhana, the first question that we'd like to ask you, the question of the day, is concerning the philosophy of fasting and the holy month of Ramadan. Some say, as it can be actually inferred from the tafsir and from the commentaries of commentaries of the Holy Quran and in hadith and narrations, it is being said that one of the philosophies of the holy month of Ramadan is to understand the situation of the poor, actually the lowest classes of the society. But unfortunately, what can be observed and seen in the society, we see that even among the believers, mu'mineen, the bad habit or custom of overeating is being aggravated in this holy month. So do you think that we are actually approaching the philosophy of fasting, or no, it's actually giving us a reverse answer?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned, there are some individual effects for fasting and also some social ones. According to the narrations, for example, fasting can help the people to strengthen their patience. Fasting can help the people to remember the Day of Judgment, because when the people are thirsty and hungry, they can remember the thirst and hunger on the Day of Judgment. It also can help the people to have more control over the passion and strengthen sincerity and ikhlas. When it comes to social effects, one of the most important effects of fasting is, as you mentioned, to somehow feel the same feelings of the poor people during the year. And there are many narrations in this regard referring to the fact that when you're fasting, one of the social effects that fasting brings about is for the believers to come to this conclusion with their heart and mind that it's so difficult to remain hungry and thirsty for many hours during the day. And this is the situation of the poor people, not only in the holy month of Ramadan, but the whole year.
Yeah.
Let me just share one narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, as quoted by Hisham ibn Hakam. He asked Imam Sadiq alayhi salam about the philosophy for fasting. Imam says that one of the philosophies for which fasting has been an obligatory act is for the people to, as I mentioned, to feel such kind of equality, so that there is a kind of equality between the poor and the rich people, so that the rich people, the well-to-do people, they also, taste hunger, they feel hunger, so that they can pay more attention toward the rights of the poor people. Let me also refer to the fact that we have in one of the supplications of the holy month of Ramadan that Allahumma aghni kulla faqir, Allahumma ashbi' kulla ja'i', Allahumma aksu kulla 'uryan. Three parts of this famous dua are related to the poor people. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to satiate every to make rich every poor people, to satiate the hunger of those people who are hungry, to prepare clothes for the people who lack enough clothes. Now, back to your question, if this is the philosophy, why some people, they somehow practice gluttony and they overeat during the holy month of Ramadan?
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio.
You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
The first point is that although you're right, I mean, some people at the time of before the morning and Fajr Adhan, they may overeat at the time of Suhoor or after the time for breaking Iftar, they may overeat. But I'm not telling you that this is something to be encouraged. This is for sure discouraged, overeating and doing israf and extravagance in eating. But given that, I mean, still, these people, although they may have eaten so much during the time of Iftar or Suhoor, still the same people will be fasting for 10, 15, 18 hours during the day.
True.
So the same people who are not, practicing a kind of moderation in eating and drinking, especially at the time of breaking the fast, they feel the thirst and hunger during the day. So it's still the same people for at least 15 hours, 18 hours, depends on the, Shari'i times of the region. For many hours during the day, they will feel that thirst and hunger of the poor people. So the philosophy is still there. So we cannot say that because they overeat at the time of Iftar, they will not have feeling the same as the poor people. No. It doesn't make any difference if you eat only a bread or, so many things at the time of Suhoor. You
actually, the question to some extent is looking at those, to some extent, actually looks at the behavior of the people in this whole month for their efforts in providing the provision for this month. It is being said, or let's say we have seen to some extent, that people actually try to buy more meat or more chicken, and to some extent they want to store it at their houses. So this is the behavior of the people that can be seen. And this judgment was based on this. Again, we see some people right after saying Allahu Akbar for the iftar time, they start eating to the level that there is no any empty place in their stomach anymore. So and we want to see if, as a Muslim, we want to break the iftar. So we need to observe some rules and regulations and recommendations that we have at the iftar time. So there must be a difference. Yes, we had actually tolerated a sort of hardship during the day, but now it's the time to break the iftar, to break our fasting. So it should be based on some recommendations from Sharia. Is there any recommendations, any behavior treatment that has been said, or is there any advice here?
For sure, what you mentioned is right, and that is why I told that we are not encouraging the act of these people.
Mm-hmm.
For sure, overeating, especially by the people who are practicing an act of worship, is something discouraged, and we have verses of the Quran and narrations. But my first point is that it's still the same people who are overeating, they will feel thirst and hunger. So the same people may reach the philosophy of fasting too.
Mm-hmm.
Although they overeat after iftar, true, but during the day they will have that feeling. Secondly, the point is that I'm not sure about the statistics. Yes, many people say that we see, before the month of Ramadan, the stores are filled with the people. But I'm not sure if this is the reality for all the people. We need to refer to the statistics, because many people, because they are not able to buy the foods during the holy month of Ramadan, they try to buy everything that they need before the month of Ramadan. So maybe some people come to this impression that buying more, compared to the previous month. But I'm not sure if this is a reality, this is a truth about all the believers. Because we need to refer to the real statistics. But my point is that it doesn't make any difference what they are going to eat at the time of lunch, they are going to eat at the time of iftar, and there is nothing wrong with that. So at the end of the day, we need to eat something at the time of suhoor and at the time of iftar to be able to fast. Otherwise, we will it would be a kind of unbearable difficulty and we will not be able to fast. So buying enough meat to eat at the time of iftar and suhoor, I think it's not against the philosophy of fasting. So maybe the same amount that we buy during the year, we will buy the same amount during the holy month of Ramadan, because we do not eat lunch, but we need to eat iftar.
Or it can be looked like this. They buy more than they need because they are going to force themselves to be to move based on the recommendations of giving iftar to others.
Yeah, that's true. Some people, they may have this,
and to serve others for iftar,
giving iftar to other people. And the last point that I would like to share is the fact that for many acts of worship, there are some philosophies and virtues and merits. If some people, by making some mistakes, they are not going to reach those virtues and philosophies, it doesn't mean that that action does not have any effect in and of itself. Let me give you some examples, for example. So prayer should prevent people from, indecent act. إِنَّ صَلَاتَ تَنْهَى عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنْكَرِ. But we have some people who, because of their behavior, because of their bad actions, they are not going to reach this philosophy. And one of the good results of prayer. So can we negate the whole act of worship like prayer because of the fact that some people are not going to reach those goals? No. I mean, this is the mistake of these people. There is a difference between, an accepted act of worship and an act of worship which is not accepted.
Very true.
Again, let me give you an example. We have, two scenarios. One, sometimes some people do not say any prayer. They would be punished for not praying. Some people, they say their prayer, but their prayer is not accepted. But there is a big difference between the two. The second group will not be punished for not saying the prayer, the prayer, because they are acting upon this obligation. But they may not reach the good results for the accepted prayer. Now, my point is that if some people are not going to reach the good results of an act of worship, it doesn't mean that there is something wrong with that act of worship. So there is something wrong with the behavior of these people. The same can be said about fasting. Fasting has this philosophy and good result. If some people, they are doing some, discouraged actions like overeating and practicing gluttony, this is something wrong with their action, not fasting in and of itself.
With the philosophy of that worshipping act that we are talking about.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh. Thanks for your enlightening answers to the questions, and you respected listeners for your staying tuned and listening to us. Please join us again in our upcoming sessions where we shall answer some other questions or doubts concerning the holy month of Ramadan and the questions around the fasting and the behavior of the Muslims in this month. Till then, I live in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
aperture.
The birth and development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols helped to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property. Though many years have passed from the abolishment of slavery, police brutality is the enduring legacy of slavery in the U.S. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. People from all walks of life regularly protest police killings of black people and broader issues of racial profiling, police brutality, and racial inequality in the United States criminal justice system. Stay with us as this documentary talks to activists, specialists, and family members of police brutality victims to depict the true picture of systematic injustice and racism in the heart of American society. Don't go away. Here's the first part.
Unconscious.
Me and my brothers and sisters sat on the, around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV. In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island.
Representing the Black Lives Matter movement, blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse.
Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles. Looks like protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown.
Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem, it's a New Jersey problem, it's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, Black Lives Matter, you know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance. But I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. And I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it, you know, it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida. Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? Well, one reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest, but it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some of the police was going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail, not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor brown person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations. It appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us, it appears as excessive. But for the officer, at a given moment on the street, it wasn't excessive. And the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street, where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage at the convenience store is not very, you know, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African-American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African-American women have been playing a central role.
Cigarettes.
Let's have him go before a jury of his peers,
yeah.
And let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, really.
That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, I mean, because I like Esther's, her list of demands, they kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement. But there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her. Yeah. Absolutely.
On July 17, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Gardner in a chokehold. Gardner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Gardner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Gardner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Gardner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's my mom is, you know, all hysterical crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, "Dad, just stop breathing." So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop, wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV, because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes, and it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we seen on the TV, on the computer, to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just like shaky. It was, I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I've never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions
the story, and it was just like, wow, I still can't believe this happened.
The Eric Garner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is the patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Garner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on the shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnback, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility, but again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
You know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about colorblindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
Just as much anger out here.
Police officers in riot gear. trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
Gifted and Safi, Ramadan Mubarak, Holy Records.
Ramadan Mubarak, لكل مسلم, شهر الذي فيها ينزل القرآن. Happy Ramadan to all Muslims. All the Quran descends in this holy month.
Insights into the Holy Quran, a special program for the holy month of Ramadan.
Welcome you, O holy man of blessings. Oh, yeah. You are sickness to my creator. For you, my soul and heart has been purified.
Oh,
in the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. This is a special program for the holy month of Ramadan. In today's program, Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi explains some verses related to this blessed month. Please stay with us.
O month of mercy, you bring so much good. We pray that it never ends. But we know you gotta go as the seasons come and go. Cause your time is set by Allah. Oh Ramadan, oh Ramadan. You're the month of the noble Quran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. We're going to be with you in this holy month of Ramadan, talking about the different verses of the Holy Quran regarding the benefits of fasting, the most important of them, piety or taqwa. We'll be with you again after you have listened to some verses of the Holy Quran regarding fasting.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Ya
O you who have believed, decreed upon you is fasting as it was decreed upon those before you, that you may become righteous.
Dear listeners, we concluded that there must be a kind of relationship between this fasting that is prescribed and the revelation of holy divine books, specifically the Holy Quran. So we tried to find the answer in the benefits of fasting. We talked about physical and social aspect. And in the previous program, we started talking about the spiritual healing. As the Holy Quran states, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الصِّيَامُ كَمَا كُتِبَ عَلَى الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. O you who believe, fasting is prescribed to you as it was prescribed to those before you, that you may gain self-restraint. We also concluded that since fasting is prevention and separation means detachment, fasting can be counted as the heart and reality of servitude to God. But fasting has many other spiritual benefits, such as patience, such as contentment, and many others that, unless one fasts, cannot